Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, subject pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you, you may proceed. Chief Justice Phillips is not here this morning, he's out on court business. He will participate in the deliberations and the decisions of the cases that will be argued this morning. The orders of the court are posted outside the door and at the clerk's office. There are three cases set for oral argument this morning. In the order in which they will be called, they are Luckel versus White, Lalue versus Hampshire Fannett Independent School District, and Schultz versus the Fifth Court of Appeals. We will take a brief recess in between the arguments of these three cases. The attorneys in the second and third cases do not have to stay in the courtroom while we argue the prior cases. But we do ask you to stand by close by so that we will proceed to your case without delay. Counsel are advised that the arguments are being recorded for the benefit of court, but if you wish to make application to hear the tapes of the arguments, you may do so by making arrangements with our clerk. We are ready to proceed with the first case, D-0080. You may call the first case.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin Hurd will present argument for petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
In this case, the court has to give a 25 minutes aside for argument.
May it please the court. I'm Tevis Hurd from Midland with the law firm of Cotton Bledsoe, and I would first like to speak to our appearance as attorneys for petitioners in this cause. The petitioners are the successors in interest to the grantees in the Mays Luckel Royalty Deed, which is the subject of this case. In October of last year, we were asked by Mr. J.M. Slater, the attorney in Houston for the petitioners in this case, to file an amicus curiae brief in this case. And we agreed to do so because, in our opinion, the case presented an important matter of public policy. No consideration was requested or received by us in our preparation of that brief, and we wrote it to bring before this court the concern of the oil and gas title lawyers in this state relative to deed construction caused by the rule in Alford against Crum. After the filing of the brief, the petitioners, through their attorney, requested that we appear as counsel to present this case before this honorable court, and we now appear as counsel with an agreement to be compensated for our services. For the ease of reference, we have submitted to the court a copy of the royalty deed that's the subject matter of this case. It's referred to in the pleadings as the Mays Luckel deed. And I would like to go over a few of the provisions in that deed before continuing with the argument. The granting clause in that deed and the paragraphs are numbered, being number one, conveys an undivided 1/32nd royalty interest. The second paragraph is the addendum and warranty clause, also referring to the 1/32nd royalty interest. Paragraph 3 and paragraph 4 are the subject to and future lease clauses of that deed, which we believe evidence an important intent of the part of the parties as to the amount of the royalty conveyed in the deed. Paragraph 3, the subject to clause, states that the royalty interest conveyed is subject to a presently existing lease, but under the terms of that lease, the grantee would receive 1/4 of any and all royalties under the terms of that lease. The lease in existence at the time the deed was executed in 1935 provided for a royalty of 1/8. Paragraph number 4 is the future lease clause, which reserves to the grantor the executive rights, bonus, and rentals, but provides that the grantee shall be paid 1/4 of any and all royalties reserved under future leases. Paragraph 5 is a restatement by the grantor of the amount of the royalties she had remaining in her after executing the present lease and the amount that she was conveying in this deed. I will come back to those clauses of the deed as we continue with the argument. The land, part of the land covered by this deed is subject to presently existing leases as referred to in the pleadings of the attorneys. Five leases presently cover part of the land that is covered by this deed. Four of those leases provide for a royalty of 1/6 and one of them provides for a royalty of 1/8, so that the question before the court is whether or not the grantee in this deed is entitled to 1/4 of the 1/6 royalty or is limited to 1/4 of the 1/8 royalty. And we, on behalf of the grantees, the successors to the grantees, suggest that the deed should be read to convey to the grantee an undivided 1/4 interest in any and all royalties, which is what the deed says, in any future lease, so that he would be entitled to that portion of the present 1/6 royalty.
You can see that the Court of Appeals, which based its decision on Alfred versus Crum, reached the correct decision in accordance with Alfred versus Crum, and that for you to prevail, this court would have to overrule Alfred versus Crum.
Yes, sir, we do, and we strongly suggest to the court that it should reconsider its position in that case. We feel like the rule that Alfred versus Crum enunciates, which we have charted on another handout we have to the court, is a rule that frustrates the intention of the parties, circumvents the four corners rule that's always been the rule of deed construction in this state, and that the we would ask the Honorable Court to reconsider the rule that was enunciated in 1984 in Alfred v. Crum, which we believe arbitrarily elevates the a proper rule of construction, that is, that the granting clause controls, to a rule of law in such a way that it frustrates the four corners rule, which is should be applied by the court to arrive at the true intention of the parties as expressed by all of the clauses in the deed. The primary rule of construction, of course, as I've said in Texas, is the four corners rule, under which each clause in the deed should be given equal weight in determining the intent of the parties. Alfred, the court in Alfred, held that the granting clause only contains the controlling language and the key expression of intent. And the Court of Appeals in this case actually said that the future lease clause should be given no effect in determining the intent of the parties to that deed. Actually, under a three-grant form of deed, which is the type of deed we have before us in the Mays Local Royalty Deed, the subject to and future lease clauses often contain language that expresses the true intention of the parties as to the fractions, as to the fraction used in the granting clause. The subject to and future lease clauses should be examined by the court to explain, confirm, or define the language of the granting clause, as the court did in Garrett v. Dills, the Supreme Court of this state in 1957. In that case, the fractions were not the same as in the as in our deed, but the proportions were the same. In Garrett, the fraction in the granting clause was the conveyance of a 1/64th mineral interest. The conveyance of the subject to clause was a conveyance of 1/8 of all royalty under the then existing lease, and the conveyance in the future lease clause, consistent with the subject to clause, was a conveyance of a 1/8 mineral interest. The court held that the grantee was entitled to an undivided 1/8 mineral interest after the termination of the lease existing at the time the deed was executed. In our deed, the fractional grants and the subject to and future lease clauses are also consistent. They're 1/4. Each of those clauses in our deeds provides that the grantee is to receive 1/4 of any and all royalties. And the subject to clause is referring to the royalty in existence at the time the deed was executed, which is 1/8. And that's how you get to the 1/32nd in the granting clause, which I will come to in a minute. Under future leases, it's 1/4 of any and all royalties under any future lease, whether it's 1/8, 1/6, or whatever it is. In Garrett, the court applied the four corners rule to determine the intent of the parties by looking at all the clauses in the deed. And they further applied the rule that the deed should be construed against the grantor. The three-grant deed form, which is the form that's used on the Mays Local Royalty Deed before us, is important to explain the use of fractions. And this deed should be read in the context of the existing legal theory at the time the deed was executed. The three-grant deed was developed in the 1920s in response to the case of Crothers versus Leonard. In that case, the deed under examination did not expressly convey the benefits, that is, the rentals and royalties, that were to be paid under an existing lease. And the court held that the language of the deed was not sufficient to pass those benefits and indicated that a separate assignment, a separate clause in a royalty or mineral deed would have to be put in to assign the benefits under an existing lease. That case was not expressly overruled by the Supreme Court of Texas until 1943. So during the 20s and 30s and early 40s, there are a number of these three grant deeds. In fact, they're still used. But during this period of time, they were expressly used by many parties, and the county courthouses are full of them. The use of inconsistent fractions resulted from another early case, Hager versus Stakes, which indicated that a lessor, after the execution of a lease, who had reserved a 1/8 royalty, had actually retained a 1/8 fee interest in the minerals. Therefore, a grantee acquiring an undivided 1/4 interest in the lessor's land should receive a deed conveying in the granting clause an undivided 1/32 interest in the subject to clause, a conveyance covering and including 1/4 of all rentals and royalties payable under the existing lease, and the future lease clause, an undivided 1/4 interest in the minerals upon the termination of the existing lease. A good explanation of that is found in Ernest Smith's treatise on Texas law of oil and gas in chapter 3.8. Our deed should be read in the context not only of the legal theory in existence at that time, but under the use of the fractions as applied to the different clauses in this free grant deed form. When you apply this analysis, there are no conflicting provisions, and the four corners rule can be applied to consider all clauses in the deed and harmonize them. The granting clause conveyed an undivided 1/32 royalty interest. The grantor had executed a deed in which she reserved a 1/8 royalty. It's reasonable to assume, under the legal theory I just talked about, that she thought she had a 1/8 royalty interest, 1/2 of which she had conveyed to her children. The subject to clause clearly explained that the royalty covered by the granting clause was 1/4 of the royalty payable under the existing lease, 1/4 of 1/8 being 1/32, the interest conveyed in the granting clause. The future lease clause provides for an identical fraction, 1/4 of any and all royalties payable under the future leases. The last clause in the deed supports the view that she thought she had a 1/16 mineral interest remaining after the execution of the lease because she had conveyed 1/2 of the interest to her children. So she started with 1/8 after she got through executing the lease. She conveyed 1/2 of that to her children. And the clause in the deed, this numbered 5, recites that she was conveying 1/2 of what she had left.
She didn't just think. That's really what happened.
Yes. Or a net 1/4 interest in the royalty to the grantee. The Alford court and the respondents criticized the future lease clause as being redundant and unnecessary. However, these clauses are found in many deeds, as I have stated. It's one thing to say that they're unnecessary. It's another thing to say that the expression of the parties in one of those clauses should be ignored in construing and trying to reach the intent of the parties as expressed by the four corners of the document. Summers Oil and Gas Section 606 notes that such a clause is helpful and should be considered to explain the intention of the parties as to the interest owned upon the expiration of the existing lease.
If you're correct, what do we do with the habendum clause and the warranty, which only warrants a 1/32 interest? You just change the 1/32 to whatever the current interest is?
Well, the warranty clause and the habendum clause refer back to the granting clause, and almost every three grant deed form like this, the parties use that fraction in the habendum and warranty clause because parties just focus on the warranty clause, on the granting clause when they refer to the place in the habendum and warranty clauses where that fraction should be inserted.
Well, assuming that that's correct, which it probably is, nevertheless, the warranty clause pretty clearly only warrants a 1/32 interest.
Mm-hmm.
How can a greater interest be read into that stated fraction, even if you're correct that somehow or another the deed should be construed where she would receive a greater royalty because of the greater royalties under the lease?
By looking at the deed from its four corners, construing all the clauses together,
and reading 1/32 mean whatever.
It's to read to read it in connection with the subject to and future lease clauses, where the expression there was one-fourth of any and all royalties. In Garrett versus Dills, the court had before it a deed that the parties agreed was unambiguous, just like the parties agree in this case. The fact that the parties to this case have pled that the deed is unambiguous should not prevent the court from applying the rule of construction against the grantor. The court in Garrett versus Dills did that after stating that the first rule that you apply is the four corners rule to reach the intent of the parties, and further said that where there is any doubt as to the proper construction of the deed, the doubt should be resolved against the grantors, whose language it is, and should be held to convey the greatest estate permissible under its language.
Well, you can confine your wandering to the four corners of this document, but still, you've got two provisions that are going to have a very different effect. And one will have to be given greater effect than the other. Doesn't it boil down to that? And Alfred gives one rule, and you're arguing for another. But
I'm arguing that the rule of construction against a grantor is a proper rule to apply in this case because it is the established rule of the state of Texas that a conveyance should be read to convey the greatest estate permissible under the terms of its language. The Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi, written by the same judge who wrote the Crum against Alford opinion, the Court of Appeals there had before it a case which involved a royalty deed that conveyed one-fourth interest in all of the royalty. And a later recital, not in the subject to or future lease clause, but a later recital in the deed which should be considered, in which the royalty was limited to one-fourth of the one-eighth. The court in that case, citing Garrett versus Dills and another Texas case, said that the deed should be construed most favorably to the grantee as conveying to him the largest estate permissible under the terms of the instrument. And therefore, since the deed said one-fourth of all royalty, just like the deed in our case does, he should not be limited to the one-eighth royalty, and that the later language, which was limiting or putting a restriction upon the earlier language, should not be considered.
If the royalty should decline to a tenth in that unlikely event, I guess your argument would still be that they should only get 40th instead of 130 seconds.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Your time expires.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Zabel, present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Zabel, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Claude Roberts, we represent the Furrow-White et al. Respondents. We have also been designated to argue on behalf of other of the respondents, including Mr. Pickett and Mr. Fortenberry and Ms. McNair, who are here in the court today. The petitioners are here today asking this court to reverse the trial court and the appellate court's construction of the Mays-Luckel deed as conveying a perpetual 132nd royalty interest as opposed to a fractional one-fourth of royalty. The Court of Appeals and the trial court in this case granted judgment in favor of the respondents on two alternative construction approaches. The first, alleged by respondents, was the harmony approach, pursuant to which the court applied the four corners rule of construction and construed the future lease clause of the Mays-Luckel deed in light of surrounding circumstances, those being that the usual and customary royalty at the time was one-eighth. They construed the future lease clause in light of that and found all provisions of the Mays-Luckel deed to be in harmony and to convey 132nd royalty interest. Alternatively, the courts held that if the future lease clause was construed as asserted by petitioners, then there was an irreconcilable conflict if you were to isolate this future lease clause and construe it out of context. And then the Alford versus Crum approach dictated that the granting clause controlled. Thus, in order to prevail in this appeal, the petitioners need to show that both of these independent construction approaches are insufficient to support the trial court and the appellate court's judgments. I would first like to point out, before getting deeply into my argument, that the amicus curiae, who has now become co-counsel for the petitioners, have improperly sought to interject reformation as a new ground for reversal Notwithstanding that this ground has not been alleged, briefed, or raised by the petitioners in the trial court, the appellate court, in their application for writ of error to this court, and they also have now sought to rely on the construction against the grantor rule, notwithstanding this was not asserted in their motion in the trial court or in any response to the respondent's motion, and was not raised in their application for writ of error to this court. Thus, the respondents submit that since neither of these matters have been properly raised, they should not be considered by this court. Contrary to what was stated in the granting of the application of the writ of error, petitioners in their application have never stated there is a conflict between the provisions of the Mays Leckel deed, but have always relied on the four corners approach. However, it is abundantly clear that their construction approach is not the application of the four corners rule at all, but is the improper isolation of one clause of that deed, the future lease clause, which they construe completely out of context without regard to any other provision of the deed or surrounding circumstances.
There is another clause which is troubling, and that's number 5. Why doesn't clause 5 show the intent of the grantor that Mr. Luker would have half of what she had?
In order to explain that, I would refer the court's attention to paragraph 3A of the code, which the Mays Leckel deed was subject to at the time the Mays Leckel deed was executed. That provides that one half of the 1/8 royalty was to be paid to Marietta Mays, the grantor under the Mays Leckel deed, and one half of the 1/8 was to be paid to her children. Thus, at the time the Mays Leckel deed was executed, she had a 1/16 royalty interest under the co-lease. And the last clause speaks expressly to this, and I would refer you to paragraph 5. It says, the next to last sentence in paragraph 5, it says, Marietta Mays conveyed one half of the 1/16 royalty, which is a 1/32. There's no reference in here to a fraction of a half as stated by petitioners to achieve a fourth. If you read the four corners of the deed, it provides one half of 1/16, which is a 1/32 consistent with every other clause of the deed.
Well, there's no question that that's true, but why doesn't that indicate an interest that she meant to convey half of what she had as opposed to a statement that she would have to make here if this were going to govern particularly this situation, and that is, and in the event the royalty interest should ever be a sixth, I mean to reserve 5/96 and convey 3/96. That doesn't sound like Marietta Mays from this instrument.
Well, if I understand your question, this last clause speaks specifically to the duration of the co-lease. She's talking about what was happening at the time the co-lease was in effect, and at that time, she was only entitled to receive a 1/16, so it conveyed one half of the 1/16. The warranty and abendum clauses both state that 1/32 spoken of in the granting clause is forever. I mean, expressly in two different places of that deed. So we submit that if you construe that last clause in light of all the other clauses, it does specifically state she's conveying one half of a 1/16, not a half of royalty.
Your view is that Alfred is right and that the abendum and warranty clauses control.
What we're asserting is, first off, if I could get into my four corners construction approach, we allege two different things. We allege that the deed could be harmonized. And the way we did that is I would like to walk through the deed. I would first like to briefly go through the court's decision in Garrett versus Dills, upon which the petitioners rely almost exclusively in their application for writ of error. So I need to go through that case to show you how our four corners construction approach works. We allege both. We said this deed could be harmonized, which a court is supposed to do under the four corners rule. Only if there is an irreconcilable conflict do you apply offer. We allege alternative approaches. First, you could harmonize the deed, and secondly, if the future lease clause was construed as asserted by petitioners, then you did have an irreconcilable conflict, and yes, we do submit to the court that offer should be followed. The Garrett decision upon which they relied, the deed construed by that court, is not only distinguishable from the Mays Leckel deed, but when the reasoning and rationale of this court's decision in Garrett versus Dills is properly analyzed, it supports the trial court's and the appellate court's construction of the Mays Leckel deed. The court in Garrett was construing a deed that contained the following provision. The granting clause conveyed a 1/64th mineral interest. The subject to clause conveyed 1/8 of the royalties under an existing lease to which the deed was subject at the time it was executed. And the future lease clause provided upon expiration of the existing lease, the grantee would receive a 1/8 lease interest and 1/8 of all future rentals under any future leases. In construing this deed, the court stated that their immediate concern was what royalty the grantee was entitled to under the subject to clause or under the existing lease. And they looked at that clause, and it said 1/8 of royalties payable under the existing lease, which was provided for a 1/8 interest. So under the Subject 2 clause, the grantee was entitled to receive 1/8 of the 1/8 royalty payable under the lease, or a 1/64. The court then turned to the future lease clause and stated they found no evidence of any intent to convey a different interest under future leases than under the existing lease. And with regard to the future lease clause, the court stated, and I quote from the court's decision in Garrett, "The future lease clause emphasizes the fact that the intention was to convey 1/8 of the royalty under future leases the same as under the original lease. The court takes judicial knowledge of the fact that the usual royalty provided in mineral leases is 1/8. The parties doubtless assumed that royalties under future leases would be 1/8 as it was under the lease in existence when the deed was executed," end quote. The court then determined that the grantee in the Garrett deed had acquired all the attributes of a 1/8 mineral interest and concluded that the deed conveyed a 1/8 mineral interest as opposed to a 1/64. Now that deed is distinguishable from the Mays-Luckel deed on three grounds. First, the granting clause and the Subject 2 clause of the Mays-Luckel deed both entitled the grantee to a 1/32 royalty. Whereas under the deed in Garrett, the granting clause and the Subject 2 clause entitled them to a completely different fraction of royalty. Second reason, the Subject 2 clause and the future lease clause of the Mays-Luckel deed as construed by petitioners provide for an inconsistent fraction of royalty, whereas the court in Garrett construed the future lease clause in a manner to make it consistent with the Subject 2 clause. And lastly, the Garrett deed deals with a mineral deed and not a royalty deed, and the Mays-Luckel deed cannot be construed like the Garrett deed was by determining what attributes of a particular mineral interest the grantee acquired. But as previously stated, not only is the deed construed by the court in Garrett distinguishable, but when the reasoning and rationale of Garrett versus Dales is properly analyzed, it supports the trial court and appellate court's construction. Now, if I can now turn your attention to the Mays-Luckel deed. In their application for writ of error, the petitioners state that the granting, warranty, and abendum clauses do convey a 1/32 royalty interest. We first look to the granting clause, which our courts have noted to be the key expression of intent and to define the nature of the permanent interest conveyed. It is also worthy to note that the granting clause is the only clause of this deed which contains any present words of grant and is the only clause standing alone which could convey any interest. The granting clause clearly and unequivocally provides grant, bargain, sell, and convey an undivided 1/32 royalty interest. Now, in order to achieve their construction approach, the petitioners state that the 1/32 royalty interest spoken of in the granting, warranty, and habendum clauses is of limited duration, that duration being only during the existence of the co-lease. However, I would refer the court's attention to paragraph 2, which contains the habendum and the warranty clause. The habendum clause provides, to have and to hold the above described 1/32 royalty interest forever. And the warranty clause obligates Marietta Mays to warrant and forever defend said 1/32 royalty interest. There's no reference to any limitation on the duration of the 1/32. In fact, the deed expressly provides in two separate places that interest is conveyed forever. Thus, in order to adopt their approach, this court would have to disregard the language set forth in two clauses of the deed. The petitioners then turn this court's attention to the Subject 2 clause, which is set forth in paragraph number 3, and state that it evidences an intent to convey 1/4 of royalties payable under leases. This clearly ignores the fact that at the time the Mays-Luckel deed was executed, it was in fact subject to the co-lease, and the parties knew and understood that lease provided for a 1/8 royalty. Thus, under the Subject 2 clause, the grantees are entitled to receive 1/4 of any and all royalties paid under the terms of said lease. 1/4 of 1/8 is again a 1/32, consistent with all of the previous clauses of the deed. Petitioners in their application then skip down to the last clause, which is set forth in paragraph 5, which we have previously discussed. At the time the deed was executed, Marietta Mays was entitled to receive a 1/16 royalty under the lease. This clause speaks expressly to that and says, by the execution of the instrument, she conveyed 1/2 of the 1/16 royalty, which is again a 1/32. They state that it evidences intent to convey 1/2 of a 1/2 or a 1/4. Nowhere in this clause does it state that. They lastly turn to the future lease clause, which we do note the court and offer did state to be an unnecessary and redundant clause, which they made the statement presumably based on two treatises written by well-respected oil and gas commentators. In reference to the future lease clause, as submitted in our brief, Words and phrases used in the deed can be construed in light of surrounding circumstances in order to determine the intent of the parties to a deed. One of these circumstances, and a very significant circumstance existing at the time the Mays-Luckel deed was executed, was that it was so usual, ordinary, and customary for landowners' royalties payable under oil and gas leases to be 1/8. The court spoke of this as a usual and customary 1/8 royalty, and it was the subject of judicial notice. Thus, at the time the Mays-Luckel deed was executed, it is clear the parties knew, understood, and contracted on the basis that the Mays-Luckel deed was subject to the co-lease, which provided for the usual and customary 1/8 royalty, and that royalties payable under future leases would be 1/8, as it was under the lease in existence when the deed was executed. Where if I apply the reasoning and rationale of Garrett and quote from that case, quote, the parties doubtless assumed that royalties under future leases would be 1/8, as it was under the lease in existence when the deed was executed. So if we correctly apply the Four Corners rule of construction, as did the court in Garrett, and we construe the future lease clause in light of surrounding circumstances, it's clear the parties intended to convey a 1/32nd royalty interest, which is 1/4 of the usual and customary 1/8 royalty. This is the only way that all the clauses of that deed can be harmonized. There is no other way.
It seems a little far-fetched that if you had asked the grantor at the time, but what if there is a 6th royalty at some point? Do you really mean to keep 596 and convey out 396? Well, what if there's a 5th? Do you really mean to keep 16/160 and convey out 560? Looks to me like they had something more of a dividing of the pie in mind than a specific fraction.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not understanding where you're getting the 96 interest from.
Well, as the amount of royalty changes, the amount that Ms. Mays is going to keep under your theory is going to raise, and the 1/32nd is going to stay constant, right?
Well, what she was to keep was anything. She only conveyed a 1/32nd, so she was to keep anything other than that 1/32nd interest.
That's right.
And if there was a royalty executed for 1/6, which there was, but it took 40 years in order for that to happen. In the court,
under your theory, she gets 596 and they get 396. 396 is a 32nd.
She would get. You're talking about under a 6th lease.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
That's correct.
And if correspondingly the royalty interest went the other way, if it went from an 8th to a 10th or a 12th or some smaller fraction,
right,
then under your theory, Mr. Lucan would still get a 32nd and she would just be out of luck.
That's what the interesting point about that, if there is a 10th lease executed, and this court was to construe this Mays-Luckel deed as conveying a 1/4 of royalty, so they'd be entitled to a 40th, they could come in under the case of Duhigg versus P.V. Moore. We're a stop to deny that that deed conveyed less than a 32nd because that's what we warranted. So they could come in, even though it would say 1/40th, they could say, no, under the warranty clause, you're a stop to assert that this deed conveyed less than a 32nd, and we could not.
Except your colleague, Mr. Bledsoe, says we have to read that 1/32nd as really meaning a 1/4 of whatever the royalty interest is. So I suppose he would not consider that you were a stop under those circumstances.
Well, I don't know how we'd get around the Supreme Court decision in that case, Your Honor. And the way that our Four Corners approach is the only way this can be harmonized. The amicus curiae, who is now co-counsel for petitioners, immediately conclude there's a conflict. They never try to harmonize provisions of the deed. I mean, they have never submitted an approach where you can harmonize all provisions of the deed. If you do convey it to convey 1/4 of royalty, you're disregarding the granting, warranty, habendum clauses, and the subject to clause, and the last clause we submit. So you're taking one provision and throwing out 5.
So if the grantor, Ms. Mays, FemSol of Chambers County, were asked at the time she signed this deed, now, ma'am, if the royalty interest that's coming out of this property goes up or down, you mean to keep the excess if it goes up and to give the excess to Mr. Lucal if it goes down? And she
correct.
Said,
correct.
That's what I mean.
Correct. That's exactly what, I mean, the court in Garrett, in 1957, almost 20 years after the deed was executed, was still talking about the usual and customary 1/8 royalty, and at that time still did not anticipate royalties being greater than an 8th. They still talked at that time about the royalties being an 8th. So, you know, we're going back to 1935. I think it is the only way the court can construe that deed to harmonize all of the provisions. Alternatively, if the future lease clause is improperly isolated, pulled out of context, it's not construed in light of other provisions of the deed, and it's construed under circumstances existing almost 40 years after that deed was executed, then it does irreconcilable conflict with other provisions of the deed. But we're saying you never need to get to that point. And they have never really contested the propriety of the court taking judicial notice of the 1/8. They've never contested that in their application for writ of error. And the only way they've ever submitted to get around that was the amicus curiae for the first time in the amicus brief, not in the application for writ of error, stated that constituted a reformation. But the approach applied by the Court of Appeals to taking of the judicial notice of the 1/8 was exactly what this court did in Garrett versus Dills. And if we were to accept their argument that that constituted a reformation, we would no longer have any four corners rule. Because any time a court tried to harmonize provisions of a deed, someone would say, well, the court reformed that deed.
The construction of this deed can't really depend upon the fact that circumstances at the time this was signed were that an eighth was a standard, can it? Because don't we have to have a rule that construes these deeds whenever they were signed and under whatever circumstances? Otherwise, we're going to get conflicting constructions of the same language.
Well, that's what we are doing, construing it under the circumstances that existed at the time. I have cited decisions by courts on both sides construing deeds on both sides of the Mays-Buckle deed, both prior to and after the Mays-Buckle deed was stated that at that time the usual and customary royalty was 1/8. And a lot of these cases are the Supreme Court cases, which had the most learned justices at the time that obviously were aware of the circumstances existing at the time they were construing those deeds and at the time those deeds were executed.
So if this were a 1990 deed, it might mean the opposite of what you're arguing for here.
If it was a 1990 deed, there is no more usual and customary royalty. I don't believe you could adopt this. This approach is merely an aid for this court to reach the intent of the parties and to harmonize the deed. I don't believe that would have any application to a 1990 deed because the court couldn't take judicial notice of that fact because I don't believe that the fact is sufficient. You could take judicial notice of that because the usual and customary royalty is not an aid, and I don't believe that there is one at this time. But at that time, I have many court cases that cite that that was what it was. And for, you know, almost 40 years after that, you had to wait before a sixth lease was executed. And a deed is to be construed at the time it's executed, not 50 years after or 65 years now, after the deed was executed.
So we don't even need to get to offer under your argument because we can harmonize provisions of the deed.
That's correct. And they have never really contested that in their application for writ of error. As I said, the only way they try to get around that is by asserting that it constitutes a reformation. But the court, the appellate court and the trial court, applied the construction approach, the four corners approach applied by the court in Garrett. That is to take judicial notice of that 1/8 and construe the future lease clause accordingly. Here they submit it to reformation, but if that's the case, I mean, they rely on Garrett versus Dills almost exclusively, but yet they say that the exact approach applied by that court is a reformation when the court called it the four corners approach. And if we were to accept that, like I said, there would be no more four corners rule because the court could never seek to try to harmonize provisions under the four corners rule because some party could always contend that the court had reformed the deed. So when we have sort of the alternative approaches, we do submit that the deed can be harmonized. And I was recently furnished with a new case. I saw this for the first time this morning. It's a new case called Snow versus Jupiter, which the petitioners have filed a supplemental brief on. And it states, I suppose you have a copy of that before you, on page 8 in the second paragraph, we suggest that the conflict is not irreconcilable if the court can harmonize all provisions of the deed. That's what we are submitting. There is an alternative here. The court can harmonize the provisions of the deed.
The offer of assent suggested that the way to harmonize this was to give it the meaning that the granted 1/32nd under the existing lease 1/4 under any future lease. What's your response to that?
My response to that is, for the first thing, it ignores the fact that the warranty and abandon clause state that 32nd is forever. Secondly, it ignores the fact that the future lease clause has no words of grant upon which to treat it as a second granting clause at all. And we also did cite it. I want to be quite candid with the court. We did bring this up rather late, but we did only recently think about that. If you construe the deed to have two grants, one grant for the duration of the co-lease, and then a new grant that is effective only upon termination of the existing lease, We have a rule against perpetuity's problem that this court addressed in Pivoteau versus Starkey because you have a shifting executory interest. So treating these things as a double grant, also I would submit the double grant theory really hasn't been brought up. It hasn't been brought up in the application for writ of error. It was raised back in the appellate court, not necessarily the trial court. The double grant theory has never been applied in a situation where you have a wealthy deed. You have to have a mineral interest granted because all double grant cases say you have one mineral interest that is granted in the granting and future lease clauses, which is the same. It subsists both during and after the expiration of the lease, and then you pick up a different royalty interest under the lease. So the double grant theories have always held there to be a distinct mineral interest and a distinct royalty interest. Never has that been used to convey two mineral interests in the same deed or two royalty interests. Today I haven't cited any cases to this court in which the court has held there to be two separate conveyances of a royalty interest in the same document. Double grant theory has never done that. And a matter of fact, the double grant theory, it was discussed in the dissent both in Garrett versus Dills and Alford, and both of the majorities rejected that approach. So we submit that their construction approach is clearly not the application of the Four Corners rule at all. They violate almost every part of that rule. They improperly isolate the future lease clause. Then they construe it apart from all other provisions of the deed. Then, rather than construe it under circumstances existing at the time it was executed, they construe it under circumstances existing over 40 years after the deed was executed. Then, rather than seeking to harmonize that provision with other provisions of the deed, they construe it in a manner that makes a conflict with every other provision of the deed. And then, rather giving effect to five out of the six clauses we speak to at 132nd, they ask this court to give effect, controlling effect, to one clause, was construed alone and under circumstances existing 40 years after the deed was executed, irreconcilable conflicts with every other provision of the deed. On the other hand, the trial court and appellate court's construction of the Mays-Lockwell deed, their harmony approach, clearly gives effect to the intent of the parties. Harmonizes all provisions of it, everything is consistent, everything evidences an intent to convey a 132nd royalty interest. Alternatively, if the future lease clause is construed out of context so that it irreconcilable conflicts with the granting clause, clearly, the better approach is to give effect to the intent of the parties expressed in five out of the six provisions and to give effect to the one clause, which creates the conflict. The Four Corners rule provides that you do not give effect to that which creates the conflict in order to destroy the intent of the parties to the deed. Thus, as submitted by Chief Justice Curtis Brown in the Court of Appeals decision, either on the basis of harmony or conflict, the Mays-Lockwell deed conveys a 132nd royalty interest. And as the last point, I would like to point out that this court, in Fleming versus Ashcroft, which is cited in our brief, they state that the Four Corners rule does not dictate that every clause be given equal effect for every question that may arise. There's nothing in the Four Corners rule that says that. And if we're looking at the granting clause, well, I see that my time is up. I would just ask this court to refuse writ or alternatively to affirm the judgments of the trial court and the Court of Appeal. Thank you.
May it please the court. Mr. Robert Bledsoe will present rebuttal arguments for petition.
Mr. Bledsoe, just as your time was expiring before, you were arguing that the governing rule here should be that the deed should be construed against the grantor.
Yes, sir.
Then I ask you, if the royalty interest declined to a tenth, would you get a 40th or a 32nd? And you said a 40th.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me if we're going to construe it against the grantor, you should get either the greater of a 32nd or a fourth of whatever the royalty is. Why isn't that true?
Your Honor, I think that the clause in the deed that's dispositive of this matter today is the fourth clause. It modifies and is to be understood with the granting clause, and that the grantee literally cannot have it both ways. The grantee is entitled to one-fourth of any and all royalties in future leases. If we were to go back to 132nd in the granting clause, Your Honor, I think we would be buying right into Alfred B. Crum, which leads me to this point. I think, does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, let me be sure.
All right.
I apologize for referring to you as Mr. Bledsoe. But regards the construction of this deed, aren't our alternatives either the majority or the dissent in Alfred?
Your Honor, I think that is precisely correct.
We've got to take one or the other.
Yes, sir. I do not. I think this is, if you don't mind my saying so, Fisher cut bait time. I don't think this is the day.
Can you think of another alternative besides the majority or the dissent in Alfred?
No, Your Honor, I really can't. I really can't, because I think that this deed may be harmonized only by looking at the four corners, and that when you go to the harmony that counsel seek on the other side, you run right into Alfred, which says, look at the granting clause. You know, it's one of these now you see it, now you don't type things. In Alfred, it says, all clauses govern. And then they say, by the way, key language, controlling language, is in the granting clause. Well, if that's the controlling language, that ends the discussion. And this is the very problem that the courts are having now. I would say there is no way to harmonize absent Alfred B. Crum. And we strongly urge the court today to consider overruling Alfred B. Crum. I'd like to call the court's attention to the recent case that was decided. Snow versus Jupiter. This case just came out on December 20th, Your Honor. And in that case, I won't go to the end of the fraction game because I think all these deeds have different fractions, but in that case, the trial court found as a matter that the intent of the parties was that the deed could be harmonized and that the estate discussed in the future lease clause was the estate that was intended to be conveyed. That was the finding of fact. Then the court in this case, Judge Arnott in the Eastern Court of Appeals, said, I regret that I cannot conform to that finding because of Alfred B. Crum. And then he refers to the effect of Alfred B. Crum just as we have.
He's right about that, though, isn't he, that we need a rule that governs this situation and not resort to whatever the circumstances were at the time or what the parties may have thought?
We do need a rule, Your Honor. I think that we have, up until Alfred B. Crum, and I've been examining titles for 35 years and lived under Garrett V. Dills for most of that time, and I can remember heaving a sigh of relief when that case came out, because I think it did nail the fact that you can look to the four corners of the deed. Because sitting there in my office examining an abstract, I read a Garrett V. Dills case, I really know what that deed says, and I wouldn't have any problem with the Mays Luckel deed until Alfred B. Crum came along. And now when Alfred B. Crum comes along, I have the same trouble that Judge Arnott had. I can't look at those other clauses as dispositive or at all suggestive of what should be done. I think that it is necessary that we be able to look at all clauses. Now you might say, gee, that creates a lot of confusion. Not so in oil and gas practice in my experience, Your Honor. And I would point out that in the Jupiter case, the court referred to something that happened to me that's quite an unusual circumstance. John Scott and I were commissioned by the Advanced Oil and Gas Institute last July to take a poll of the oil and gas lawyers in the state, or a number of them, to ask what are the 10 most regrettable decisions of the Supreme Court of Texas. The idea not being to criticize this honorable court, but to look at those things, to remember them so that we could be sure we use them in our day work. but also to say that this is pretty tough to live with. Now, we took that poll and we wrote the paper, and as the court points out on page 7, Alfred V. Crum was one of the stars in this poll. And I realize you can't live by polls, or as the court calls it in here, Mr. Blackwell's best dressed list. You can't just look for polls at institutes. But I would say, I'd like to call the court's attention to the fact, now in the paper we did not say which case won the worst of all contest. But I did say at the talk, and we handed up a little bit and said, now the envelope please. But Alfred B. Crum was the winner by a long shot. I had a number of lawyers whose names I didn't take down or record who called in and said, I'm not going to vote on the rest, but right now I've got more trouble with Alfred B. Crum than any other case the Supreme Court's ever decided in the oil and gas area. Then Luckle B. White comes along, and we have this opportunity as amicus. And I would have to say I am happy to appear before the court today and to talk about this, because it's something that I cope with every day, and so does Mr. Hurd, and so do a lot of the oil and gas lawyers in this state.
Mr. Sable makes the argument, however, that we will not have to reach Alfred versus Crum if the deed can be harmonized, and you made no effort at all to harmonize the different provisions of the deed.
Your Honor, we do seek harmony here today, but we don't seek harmony at the expense of just ignoring the fact that Alfred V. Crum says, we want harmony, but in the process of harmony, it's kind of like the husband saying to the wife, I want harmony, but let me tell you what, this is how it's going to be. In this case, the court said the key expression of intent is in the granting clause in Alfred. Well, I'm just saying that when you say that, that's like the husband saying, sit down and shut up, and we'll look at this thing from all standpoints. It just doesn't, it doesn't work that way in as a practical matter. I think that what we had in Garrett v. Deals was a recognition of what the problems were in three grand deeds. And we lived with that, and it works. It works. But we've got, you might say, well, gee whiz, let's try a situation where the granting clause always governs and we can just quit worrying about that. I think in reading Alfred, there was some of that thought. And that is a, that is something to address. And I'd like to say to this honorable court, that doesn't work in practice, because who prepared deeds as a practical matter? We do not have people coming to oil and gas lawyers' offices to do deeds like this many times. It's been a year and a half since I prepared a mineral or a royalty deed for somebody. It's done by notary publics, county clerks, real estate people, abstractors. They don't know anything about this key expression of intent being in the granting clause. They use forms. They use some of the old forms. And we've got 70 years now of deeds that were prepared that didn't know anything about the key expression of intent of the granting clause. We've got to live with those. And a rule that says granting clause is the punch to the chin skews all of that. And that's why it's so hard to live with. I would like to point out that in this Code Jupiter case, the court said this: the Supreme Court has already adopted the repugnant to the grant rule in Alfred, and we must follow that rule, even if these results are contrary to the party's intent. We would respectfully suggest that the Supreme Court reconsider the application of the repugnant to the grant rule. One thing I'd like to point out to the court,
well,
that
in the area of land titles,
yes, sir,
and in perhaps none other in the law, stability in the applicable rules is important.
Yes, Your Honor, that is exactly right. It is something that we need a great deal. We have got thousands of private opinions that have been written on Garrett v. Dills. Now, that's, you know, maybe they were wrong under Alfred v. Crum. We've all had to look at that and say, what are we going to do with all these files that were Garrett v. Dill files? But that's not your problem. But I'm just saying it does create a stir. And I want to go back to one thing that I think that the court might be wondering about here today, and that is, what is this granting clause prevailing doctrine? Where does it come from? What sorts it out?
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.